Welcome to the Gifters Podcast. I'm your host, Christopher Kai. This podcast is sponsored by the GPS Online Program, which teaches you how to turn your story into a successful speaking and online coaching business. For more information, go to ChristopherKai.com. Our guest today is Ed Tyson. He is the founder and CEO of Per Synergy Consulting. He's also an author and speaker, as well as consultant. Ed, welcome to our show today.
Oh, thank you very much, Christopher. So glad to be here.
So you talk about leadership, which is literally my favorite topic. But before we dive into your expertise in leadership and your book and your experience as a consultant, what's a story you can share with us that really tells our viewers and listeners who you're about and who that story can encapsulate you in terms of how you are a leader?
Wow. Well, the one that comes to mind first is probably the most formative event in my life, which was as a young man, 17 years old, I begged my mother to sign the papers because I wasn't allowed to join the Marine Corps. And so I went off the Marine Corps Reserve, started school at Penn State, but then promptly got yanked from school and sent to the shores of Cuba. And at that time in my life, boy, the world was white and black, good and evil to me in my young mind. And that was the mindset that I went to Cuba with. And on the shores of Cuba, we were there to help secure some refugee camps where people had been scooped up out of the water. And instead of brought to the shores of Florida, like in the Marion boat lift in the 80s, we put them in Guantanamo Bay at our base there. Anyhow, you know, after experiencing some riots and some activities there that really challenged me as a human, I went off by myself, sat on the shores of Cuba, looking out over the water, smoked a cigar, and I just remember staring at the end of that cigar and all of the layers that it had, and I thinking about the experience, how I handled it, you know, very much in that black and white frame of mind and what it meant about me and who was I, and my world started to unravel a bit. And, you know, if you had this black and white, all of a sudden they started to separate and give way to a whole lot of gray. And that really forced me into a lot of reflection while I was there. And when I went back and to Penn State, I changed my major from criminal justice to philosophy, and it really was the start of a different journey for me, a different plan forward.
Before we dive into your career and your education, I'm really curious, we talked about working with these refugees. What's something that you feel that a lot of people, because as soon as you hear the word refugee, everyone has a connotation, but what's something that you feel you learned from that experience of working with people that, yes, they're refugees, but they're also human beings. So any eye-opening insights that you learned at that moment?
Well, you know, what I saw predominantly was groups of people trying desperately to better their lives and being willing to risk everything to do it. You know, we really weren't, the Marines weren't allowed a lot of interactions with the refugees, but you could just see in the people that these were good people trying to better their way of life. And, you know, the politics of the situation had gotten in the way. They were trying to get to a better place. We were not allowing mass immigration. And they were then hearing on the radio from Castro saying, I'm welcoming you back, but, you know, they won't let you come. And of course, that was not the case. But so that was creating a lot of frustration. And seeing that was just so disheartening. And so difficult. I mean, we had, you know, former Olympians in one of the camps and things. So, you know, we're talking all walks of life, people just trying to make their lives better and risk everything for their families to do it.
Yeah, that's very profound. Now, when you get back to Penn State, I mean, I took one philosophy class, Ed, and I was like, this is way too deep for me. For you, why did you choose like criminal justice to philosophy, and why that, given that now you're currently an entrepreneur?
Well, you know, there's a couple of things. My coursework at Penn State, just, you know, in my undergraduate, even at that young age, just one thing kept leading to another. So if you rewind it back to my coursework in criminal justice, I was taking some ethics courses that were part of the required. And so that was out of the Department of Philosophy. And as I thought about how do I make a shift, I thought about my love, actually, for some of that introspection, despite being kind of more of an extrovert. I still really like to think deeply. And that really led me to the philosophy department. And interestingly enough, the philosophy department itself, when you're studying philosophy, you're basically also studying comparative religion, led me to a class on sectarian movements and cults and all of the kind of aberrant behavior that can happen in a cult-like environment. And boy, I was hooked on small group dynamics. So it was by way of kind of strange and aberrant behavior that brought me in, but really the richness of the study of groups, group psychology, and what do humans do well and do poorly when they get together in groups pulled me in and led me to then study organizational psychology in graduate school.
And what did you find interesting about cults?
Well, you know, it was a lot of studying a lot of the dynamics, both ones we would expect to see in terms of some very aberrant behavior, but also some leadership characteristics, things that I expected to find, like you might have non-neurally typical humans. So people with one disorder or another flocking. And in fact, that was not what the data shows. And so really you're talking about something else happening with a charismatic leader, willing to, speak or prophesize around a platform consistently to a group that's been isolated from other information sources that perhaps they previously trusted, and how quickly that can actually form a new worldview and have a massive impact on all of the individuals in the group and get them to do things that, you know, they're upbringing may have specifically shied against and that they'd never engaged in before, but suddenly willingly engaging in that activity. I just found it super fascinating, the impact of culture and group norms on individual behavior.
So as you're sharing this, Ed, I can tell you're a very philosophical guy. You're a very deep guy. Now, how do you go from being at Penn State to going into healthcare, hospitality? Now you're the CEO and an author. So where is that transition and transformation for yourself to really not just understand this, Ed, but you really want to start helping other people with your clients' work?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny. I just gave a keynote speech to the Pennsylvania Healthcare Association, which is a healthcare association that services post-acute care facilities, their owners, their management teams, their clinical teams, et cetera. And it was actually the place that gave me my first job when there was nothing on my resume except for 6 years of Marine Corps service and
wait. First of all, thank you for your service. Even except for, just so you know, thank you for your service.
Thank you. I super appreciate that. But I can remember joking later with my hiring manager, and she said the reason she picked me, she said, well, this guy's either a psychopath or pretty interesting. So she went with pretty interesting and had me come in. But this group, this association literally gave me my first job. I was manager of member relations, but really manager of a function, not any people. And I had no idea what I was doing. And they really helped develop and mold my thinking. Had a bunch of marvelous mentors. But what my time there did was set me on a path inside of healthcare, where I then took a job with one of their largest members and then got recruited from the East Coast to the West Coast. And, you know, just was able to engage in a career of capability building and, kind of strategic development of people, process, and technology that set in motion some thinking in me about the importance of understanding your purpose and how that builds resiliency, understanding the work before you try to improve the process, and then thinking about everything as process. And those three things really have a direct pull through into my book and the work I do and the leadership SOPs development philosophy.
Yeah. See, as I said to our listeners and viewers prior to starting, where I was saying, you know what, the topic of leadership is so powerful. It's such a term used often, but I used to work for American Express in New York City on Wall Street. And I started off as a compliance analyst. I used to do these internal control evaluation processes. And then I went on to the more sales support side. But what really gave me a deep understanding of business was that every single Fortune 500 company, any single government organization that has lasted the test of time always has systems, processes, and structures. So for you, talking about the leadership SOPs, when I was researching you, learning about your story, Ed, it really made a very, very, very clear distinction between you as a leadership expert and everyone else. Meaning, wow, when you said that the definition of leadership or the origin of leadership, in your specific words, was that it's about having an objective, but it's an objective that you can't do yourself. And you talked about this capacity building and having that team. It's not just getting to the objective, which you know very well as a Marine or as an executive, but it's about, no, who are you bringing along? You stress community over and over again. So let's first talk about why you are so passionate about community. It's crystal clear that you're smart, you're intelligent, you're ambitious, you're a leader, you're a keynote speaker, but a lot of leaders that I meet, and I've literally met some of the biggest ones in the world, they have a bit of an ego. They don't talk about community or team. They talk about themselves. So I'm curious, when did you realize that really this teamwork, this community, this capacity building was so integral to the very foundation of what you're referring to as this objective and not doing it yourself? That's such a profound statement.
Well, you know, I think it was from trying to do what everyone else was doing for a while and recognizing it wasn't working, or at least it wasn't working any better than what they were doing. And since I had this process improvement background, I thought, well, hey, you know, idiot, no wonder if you're doing essentially what everyone else is doing, of course you're not doing it any better. You know, that's just kind of antithetical to the whole process improvement mantle that you hold at your core. So that really caused me to think deeply about what is our general approach to leadership development? What is the problem we're trying to solve? And I really anchored to a report I read. It was a 2018 global leadership study. And what struck me was it said that, you know, only 14% of leaders say they have the leaders they need to implement the strategy. So they're not talking about a recruitment gap that they can't find, you know, they're saying, I've got people in these roles and I'm passing judgment on them that they are not leading and they're not capable of driving the kind of transformation I need. And that just hit me in the gut as such a big problem, bigger than what I had previously been working on or thinking about. I think I previously, if I was honest with you, what I thought I was doing was working with people to increase their emotional intelligence, open them up to the idea of enhancing their interpersonal relationships as a way to get things done.
Yeah.
And well, go ahead.
No, but let's talk about this leadership SOP, because I really want to dive in and let our viewers know how important and profound it is, because just those three words, again, I'm a geek with words, right? So it's, you have standard, which you have to have standards. If there's no standards, there's nothing to shoot toward, there's no ideals. Then operating, it has to actually work. It's not theory or philosophy, let's say, but then procedures, it's literally, you have to have a protocol. And again, whether you're looking at American Express, where I worked for 20 years ago, and it's still around 170 years later, to Toyota, and Toyota, they popularized this process improvement methodology called 5 Whys or Kaizen of this process improvement. Sure. And I'm sure you probably heard of this, where I can tell you ask a lot of questions. That's why any clients that work with you, they should literally just applaud you before they even pay you, because you have to ask those 5 why questions, just diving deep, because the whole process improvement, standards, what are standards if you don't even ask questions? Operating, well, you can be in theory, but if it doesn't operate, it doesn't matter. And if you don't have an actual procedure, then all that really is just words that you're putting together. So I'm fascinated by how you even piece together leadership SOP. I'm curious about the origin of even those three powerful words attached to leadership.
Yeah, well, I got to tell you, I often start things one way and then stop myself and recognize I'm not following some of my own core beliefs about the way you solve problems, et cetera. And my arriving at the leadership SOPs was absolutely no different in that, you know, here I was looking at exact problem I just expressed to you a moment ago. You know, if I'm going to use the same process as everyone else, I'm not going to get great results. And what I was really poking at the time, the problem I was seeing, is I could make kind of immediate improvements with a leader, but then I walk away and it starts to fall away, right? They just did not inculcate the new behaviors and the new beliefs, et cetera, so that they just kind of returned back to their previous state at some point, or just didn't continue to improve. Either one was kind of unacceptable to me. And so I started to think about how could I make the change last? I thought about John Kotter's book, Leading Change, and he has 8 steps to driving enterprise change. The 8th one is making sure you anchor the change in the culture of the organization. And so I thought, what's that mean at an individual level? Well, it's really your process, your habits. And so I thought, well, I have to better, you know, it seems kind of simple, like all great ideas when you're thinking about them, you know, simple once you break it down. But I thought, I'm not helping people really anchor this in their process. That's when I started to think, you know, what is the real leadership in the real world? Not what's in our heads about what we think we know about it, our potential leadership, but our behavior is what leadership is. And it's not one heroic act. It is day in, day out. And I thought, this is process and I know process. So I started calling it leadership systems, completely unsexy, not sticky at all, and nothing like a brand or a methodology. It was just how I talked about it, how I did my work with my clients. And then one day, I'm an auditory processor at heart. So one day I'm just talking and I said, you know, yeah, your leadership systems, you know, your processes for leading, your leadership SOPs. And it stopped me cold as I said it. I realized that I had just given birth to a thought that was going to be super important to the rest of my life. And I was, the more I thought about it, the more I really hoped to would be important to millions of leaders. And that was that leadership is a process. And you asked that community question before, and what I would say, it's not just a process, it's a process of social organization meant to solve that problem you articulated. When me plus effort does not equal success, when I can only imagine success if it's a community times effort, right? Some synergy in there equals success. And therefore, the fundamental thing that leadership is about is really building that capacity. But the problem that I was seeing was that most leaders stay focused on their passion for their craft that drew them to the job and the objectives that either somebody asked them or they woke up one day with a belly full of passion to pursue. They kept their eyes on that. And so to them, leadership was no more than a tool to get work done through people. And the reality is that you can't solve the problem that way. You've got to look at what you need to design, engage, and improve, or in my terminology, structure, operate, and perfect. So the reality is the leadership SOPs is not just your standard operating procedures, it's your standard operating procedures for structuring, operating, and perfecting your communities of effort. So the SOP is actually used twice, first referring to our methodology, and the second for our framework for leading. So it's really a double entendre that's lying there.
Smart marketing, Ed.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, in whether it's the Marine Corps or healthcare, both of them drove home the power of remembering, simplifying concepts and remembering them through acronyms. So you'll find them all over the place. The deeper you dive, the more acronyms you find. And it's not just because that, it's also because I have a terrible memory for detail, but this is something you have to remember. So I had to build it in a way that I would be able to systematically talk about it with my clients and spot areas where they need to develop.
Yeah. One thing you said that's very profound, Ed, is that it is really the process. So now that you have this cool, sexy, marketable term, which is leadership SOPs, but you also have the nuts and bolts, because again, this is why most people are not great leaders, because there actually is ordinary things you need to do every day to become extraordinary. And you and I talked in a conversation prior to this interview about how the 7 habits of how they affect the people with Stephen R. Covey, one of the most profound books that I've read 25 plus years ago. But I think he talked about you have to do ordinary things, ordinary habits to become extraordinary. So let's really dive into that, because is your book about these SOPs or is your book about other things as well? Let's talk about your book.
Sure. Well, first, I'll answer the last part first, and then maybe I'll be lucky enough to stumble on the first question. So the book itself begins with an introduction that talks a little bit about this story we're telling here, about how did I kind of wander around and find the leadership SOPs methodology and framework, and what is it? And I try to relatively succinctly get to that point, because what follows then is a story. about a number of scientists who are on the road from expert to executive. And it talks about, you know, how do they come to terms with the real purpose of leading, this idea that leading is about the cultivation of communities of effort that are commensurate with the challenges we're presented. And it talks, it gives that many different views of that. So one is, you know, your classic CEO who does not respect the importance of building a community of effort and really is focused still on the science. And in fact, is the really the chief science officer, not being the CEO, and really not even being the chief science officer, more like being the lead scientist, right? So it's just like, you know, operating significantly down below the level of thinking, all the way to when this individual has kind of a conversion of how do they change their basic standard operating procedures for leading such that they're bringing on new scientists and explaining to them that every step on the road from expert to executive is away from your craft. And those are the first words of the book, actually. And once that character understands that and imparts that to someone else, then we get to see what does she do with that? As she decides, maybe she's going to make a willful choice into leadership and take some steps away from the science. So that's kind of what the book is about. But to go back to what's inserted in there is the idea of how do you get the methodology right? Mm-hmm. How do you get that repetition right? And what do you drive it at? And that's where the framework comes in, is making sure you've got robust processes, personal SOPs for structuring, operating, and perfecting your communities of effort. So there's kind of, you know, like 28 dimensions that lie under there that some of which are explored in the book and some of which we don't want to bore readers. We want it to be an easy read and something that creates a lot of ahas.
So at 28 dimensions, let's say I'm a Fortune 100 company, and I come to you asking for your potential services. What are some basic initial questions you ask a client about their leadership skills and how you could potentially help them and really help this, as you call, capacity building?
Yeah, sure. So an individual client, which you know, typically the master client is the organization, and then it's the individual leaders that I'm partnering with. And when I sit with them, what I really want to know is how do they conceive of leadership? Part of the reason that I recognized I needed to do the work I did to try and distill down what is leadership is because what a mess this is, and how so many of us just think of leadership as the quality of interpersonal engagement. Well, that to me is more membership, is how, what kind of citizen am I? It doesn't really speak to the work of leading. And so what I want to understand is the answer to three questions. I want to understand, what do they think is the purpose of leading? What is leadership for? Then what do they think the core work of leading is? If they were writing the job description, don't tell me about the skills that will help you do it better. Tell me about the job functions. What do you think they are? And then the third is I want to know the ways in which they've distilled that into their own repeated personal practice or their own leadership SOPs, which of course they don't have that in their language typically when I'm meeting with them. But I want to get the answers to those three questions predominantly to start our work together. And then what we do from there is begin to engage in that deeper conversation about the right sizing or the tweaking or adjustment of how they're perceiving leading and their role in the organization. And then we work and we just kind of comprehensively explore all those dimensions I mentioned, but we don't try to influence all those dimensions. We're just looking for the 2 to 3 areas where we can make a substantial change by rhythmically engaging in a routinized way in some new behaviors. You know, quick examples, you know, how often you meet with your staff, how often do you meet with the employees of your employees? So the if you're leading leaders of leaders, which most of my clients are. Other examples, how often are you looking at your organizational structure to make sure that it's designed to deliver today's strategy, not yesterday's? You know, just as just some examples, how often do you coach? How often do you mentor? That kind of stuff. And what we really want to do is make a substantial improvement, but begin to help create this platform that they will forever be using to stand on and improve. And the repetition piece that you asked about earlier, but we really didn't dig into, is so important because it builds personal proficiency. So when I do something again and again, even if I didn't have feel, like kind of grabbing a baseball bat for the first, if I didn't have that natural feel that a lot of major leaguers will tell you they had the very first time they grabbed that bat, they could just feel something magic. Well, others of us just grab a bat, we just feel a stick in our hand that's strangely shaped and got a knot at the end and we don't know where to hold it. But you swing it a million times and you start to develop that feel. And that's what the leadership SOPs are about, but it's not just that. It's that by establishing these patterns, you're effectively creating plays. And plays are patterns of behavior for others to basically also experience is the absolute key, the foundation for predictability, which means trust and complex collaboration. You can't have it unless you build some type of repetition from which you can riff and you can start having lots of variations. But look, coaches have known this forever. That's why they operate from playbooks and just drill those plays all the time. The Marine Corps knows this. That's why we do military drills all the time of marching. It's why we do ambush drills. It's why, you know, it's to build this behavior so we all know what everyone else is going to do. And as people adjust, we start to understand how we need to adjust. So if you don't do that for your team and you're a haphazard, chaotic leader who's not establishing plays, who has no leadership SOPs, you're creating a whirlwind of havoc around which nobody can begin to create patterned cooperation and collaboration. In fact, what they do is they decide which you they like and which behaviors they like, and they spend all their time trying to figure out how can I create the environment which gets that you. Christopher, how can I get the you that I like? The you that's on a good day, right? And so essentially what that breeds is a codependent environment where your staff is constantly trying to manipulate you, to use nastier words for what I just said.
I appreciate how specific, concise, and precise you are with your wording, because again, when you have this process improvement mindset, it really comes to that repetitiveness where, again, it doesn't sound sexy per se, but that's literally how you become successful. So to end our show, Ed, is there one story, one concept, one message you want to share with our viewers, really just anchor in what they most should learn about you and why they should really work with you? Because you have this profound way of understanding leadership. Like I said, everyone talks about leadership. You're the first person I've met in many, many years that really defined it. Look, you have an objective. Many leaders focus on an objective, which sounds great. It's fun to talk about, but if you cannot do it by yourself, which none of us can, you need to build that capacity building through process, and in your case, standardized operating procedures. So one final message to share with our viewers and listeners, Ed?
Absolutely. So I'll say there's just a lot of depth to the topic and a lot of breadth, but the most important thing is anchoring on the purpose of leading. And the interesting thing is what's in the way of that is our passion for what we do. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. I've been spending a lot of time returning to my roots in healthcare, specifically post-acute care. So these are people running skilled nursing and assisted living facilities across the United States. And as I talk to them and listen, look 5% of COVID cases in those facilities, 40% of deaths. They are tired, they're hurting, and they're trying to figure out how to lead when they walk through their facilities and they just see so much work. And their passion for that work, their passion for their patients is in the way of them making sure that their community of effort is willing, capable, and sustainable. And those are the three things you must produce. And they are willing because they are all themselves locked in to this patient and caregiving heart. And they are capable because they've been doing this for a long time. But that sustainability question is the one that their passion for the work, their ability to spot the work that needs to be done and lean in and do that is keeping them from spending enough time on making it sustainable, which is ultimately eroding the willingness and the capability. Mm. So you have to start, whether you're in healthcare or you're a scientist or you're an engineer, or you're in technology, you have to recognize as a leader that your passion for what you do is the biggest barrier to allowing you to set that aside and focus on the community of effort you have to cultivate.
And that's a great way to end our show. Literally, it's about that community that we cultivate, but really everyone should be learning from you because it's so hard to do two things at one time. Let's say I'm a brilliant writer, but I need an editor. Or you have a Steve Jobs that promotes things, but you need a Wozniak to do the work. And in your case, you have this macro understanding of the marketing side of a Steve Jobs, but you also have the analytical process-oriented side that every single person that builds any sustainable company, organization, or leader has. So Ed, thank you so much for being on our show today. Thank you for listening to the Gifters Podcast. If you want to learn how to turn your story into a successful speaking and online coaching business, go to christopherkai.com to learn more.